Okay, we're picking up in chapter 19, where we left off. Paul was in Ephesus, and Apollos, remember, went to Corinth from Ephesus, so he continued preaching after he was straightened out about the baptism of Jesus as opposed to the baptism of John. And Paul at Ephesus goes into the synagogue, but then he leaves because he has that problem with the Jewish part there, the Jewish reaction to the Judaism that the Jews were trying to keep, and in this case, were just denying Paul of what he was preaching about. So he moves to the school of Tyrannus, and he brings the disciples from there that have heard him to that school, and he's there for 2 years. And then we saw too that he had there were the seven sons of Sceva, who were the fake prophets, and remember they tried to throw out the demon by saying we're going to cast you out by the power of Jesus who Paul preaches. And the demon said, "We know Jesus, we know Paul, but who are you?" And then he beat him up and threw him out naked. And it made a big impression on the town. And then after that, we looked at where the magic books were burned. They saw, the people there saw what a fake thing it was. 50,000 pieces of silver worth, which is about $7 to $8 million worth today. And then the next thing was a riot in Ephesus. Demetrius and the silversmiths rising up and saying, "You're taking away our business," is basically what their problem was. So that's where we ended last time in verse 28 of chapter 19. And when they heard this, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, "Great Diana of the Ephesians." And so there was this just fierceness, actually. The word wrath there is a fierceness that they had, that they were shouting this. So the whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater, which, and actually, before I get to the theater, yeah, there is the Temple of Diana. This is rebuilt in Ephesus. And I didn't even check if this is built to scale. I don't think it was. But this is what it looked like. And remember, when we looked at, we're looking at historically, that temple was so big. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. And you could fit three or four of Solomon's temples inside it. Those columns are marble, and they're 60 feet high. When we looked at Solomon's portico, those columns were 27 feet high, which is higher than this ceiling. But these are 60, so more than double that. It's just an enormous building. And so that was the temple there. And then this is the theater that's still there that they rushed to. The whole city was filled with confusion and rushed into the theater with one accord. Estimates between 25,000 and 50,000 would fit in this. And I think they don't know how much farther it went than what's still there. But a huge stadium, having seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, Paul's travel companions. So Paul's not there, so they grab these two guys, Paul's friends, and they bring them into here. And when Paul wanted to go to the people, the disciples would not allow him. So Paul is kept from these beasts, and I call them beasts because that's what, in 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul recounts this story, he talks about the beasts in Ephesus. It was a scary situation. 2 Corinthians 1:8, when Paul writes the 2 Corinthian letter, he talks about this and said, "We despaired for our lives." And then he talks about his friends, Aquila and Priscilla, in Romans chapter 16, and says, "They laid down their lives for me," or their necks for me. So Paul had good friends, but these were scary situations. Verse 31, "Then some of the officials of Asia who were his friends sent to him, pleading that he would not venture into the theater." These are Asiarchs, and they're 10 there were 10 elected city chiefs of Asia. So apparently there are chiefs of different cities in Asia, but some of them were in Ephesus at the time. And they know Paul, and they're telling him, don't do it, Paul. And verse 32, some therefore cried one thing and some another, for the assembly was confused, and most of them did not know why they had come together. So this is a confused mob, and it's been risen, it's been stirred up by Demetrius and the silversmiths. Remember that? He stirred this up. And most of them didn't know why they're there. Verse 33, and they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander motioned with his hands and wanted to make his defense to the people. Now, they want Paul. They won't. The Asiarchs and his friends say, "Don't go out there." So they drag. They don't drag. Alexander goes out there, and he's a Jew, and it's almost like adding fuel to the fire. They know about the Jewish ideas, and you want a Jew to talk to us about Diana of the Ephesians, and it's just like Alexander was probably going to make, well, it says he was going to make a defense for himself, and not for Paul. And probably going to say something about Paul doesn't know what he's doing. He's an erring Jew. This is what we are. This is who we are. But he never even got that far. Verse 34, and when they found out that he was a Jew, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours, "Great Diana of the Ephesians." So they were furious, and this fuel on the fire, putting up another Jew to talk to them, and they just shout for 2 hours. And what a mob mentality was going on there. Verse 35, and when the city clerk had quieted the crowd, now usually when we think of a clerk, we think of not an important person, but this was a city clerk at that time, had an important position. He was in charge of the money and the recording of events. He was the magistrate in the area. And in fact, they've got coins that they found in Ephesus that show and list the magistrate, the clerk of the city, this particular position. So he effectively quiets the crowd, and he says, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know that the city of Ephesians is temple guardian of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Zeus?" So he describes Ephesus, and really this word that he's using, this temple guardian, is another thing that's been found on Ephesian coins. Ephesus, we are the guardians of the temple of Diana. So and so he's talking in this way, and you can imagine the response. Yeah, that's right. This is undeniable, of course. And verse 36, therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly. We know this. Don't leap before you think. Look before you leap is what I meant to say. Verse 37, for you have brought these men here who are neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of your goddess. So these men are not guilty of acts, temple robbery, or words. They haven't blasphemed Diana. And of course, most of the mob, remember, they don't know. Most of them don't know why they're there. He continues, therefore, if Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. So Demetrius, the silversmiths, go to the courts. And he may have turned this mob's feeling around to all of a sudden understanding that, man, Demetrius and his guys really used us in this mob mentality. They just drew us into this. So anyway, it effectively quells this. Verse 39, but if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined in the lawful assembly. So is there anything else? Go to court. Verse 40, for we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar, there being no reason which we may give to account for this disorderly gathering. So he's telling them, Rome might hear this. Remember, what Rome was, they would take an area and control it. They would pay taxes to Rome, but what Rome offered was peace. And here is a lack of peace. And how are they going to answer? What reason will you give to Rome when they come to you and say, what happened here? There's no good reason. So Ephesus stood to lose some of its freedoms or be punished in some way. And so that's what he's telling them. And when he had said these things, he dismissed them and pretty much said, now go home. And then remember, Gaius and Aristarchus were two that were seized. Paul wasn't there, so they grabbed his buddies, but they're going to be released. We're going to see them Aristarchus in chapter 20. And Aristarchus shows up again in chapter 27 as a fellow prisoner with Paul. And also he's mentioned in Colossians. So now we move to chapter 20. After the uproar had ceased, Paul called the disciples to him, embraced them, and departed to go to Macedonia. So here Paul has been 3 years in Ephesus. He's called it a great and effectual door that has been opened there. And it seems like that started when the superstition was just decimated, when all the magic books were burned. There was a great door that was opened at that time. But he has to leave town over this riot. He departed to go to Macedonia. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, when Paul is in, let me give a little background. When Paul is in 1 Corinthians, or in Ephesus, Chloe from Corinth comes to Ephesus with this list of problems that Corinth is having. And then Paul writes a letter and gives it to Titus to bring back to Corinth. And it's a tough letter. Of course, it's 1 Corinthians. And what is 1 Corinthians? It's just a long list of problems that Corinth was having. And he was nervous about it. And he wrote it with tears, he says. But he sent it back with Titus. And so then here in, where was it? 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And verse 12, furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel and a door was opened to me by the Lord, I had no rest in my spirit because I did not find Timothy, my brother, or Titus, my brother, but taking my leave of them, I departed for Macedonia. So Paul wrote this letter, then he goes up to Troas, and he's thinking he's going to meet Titus. Somehow, he told Titus, deliver this, and then somehow he let him know to come back around. Let's go to that map again and see. Oh, I don't have a pointer, but you can see from Ephesus that you can, as you go up to Troas, so he's at Troas, and he's expecting Titus to come from Corinth and come up around to Troas. And so he expected to see him at Troas, and he didn't see him. And it's interesting that here a door is opened. He's writing 2 Corinthians, and he told him that a door was opened to me there in Troas, but I had no rest in my spirit because I didn't find Titus. I took my leave and went for Macedonia, which is, he was worried. Where is Titus? I sent this letter. I'll bet the Corinthians just jumped on him. And so he had a lot of anxiety there. And so he continues around and leaves Troas to continue around, really thinking, Titus is coming up. I'm going to continue and meet him maybe in Philippi, maybe in Berea, maybe in Thessalonica, maybe in Athens. He's looking to catch up with Titus and see what happened. Verse 2, now when he had gone over that region and encouraged them with many words, he came to Greece. So right in here, he meets Titus. Now we're going to, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, we find out where he talks about this. So obviously this happened before he wrote 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5 and 6, he says, for indeed when we came to Macedonia, he's left Troas, he's gone over to Macedonia, heading to Corinth. Our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. Nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comfort us by the coming of Titus. Titus came, and a burden was released from him. And so somewhere there, and maybe between Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea, we don't know where in there, Titus, he runs into Titus, and then he writes a letter back to Corinth, and he sends it ahead of himself. He sends it down to Corinth and of course, what is 2 Corinthians about? Comfort, how much he's comforted. And there's that one chapter where it's comfort, comfort, comfort. And it's almost like so much emotion there from we found Titus and everything's okay. Corinth took the letter. They're changing. And so you see these emotions that he's going through when you read the 2 Corinthian letter. Romans chapter 15, we won't go there right now, but he talks about going to Illyricum, which is another city. It's not on here. It's, it would be west of Berea. When you see Berea, it goes off the map from Berea. So, and it's probably here where he took a side trip and went to Illyricum. I imagine he first saw Titus, okay, now I'm going to go to Illyricum and preach to them. So that's probably where that took place. In verse 3, and stayed 3 months. Okay, he came to Greece, which would probably be Corinth, and stayed 3 months. And when the Jews plotted against him as he was about to sail to Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. So while he's in Corinth there, he writes Romans, that's where he talks about Illyricum, and Galatians. The Jews plotted against him, so he was going to go one way. He's going to sail over to Syria, back towards home. But he changes his route. Probably he got word that some Jews were planning to hurt him or thwart him in some way. So he goes back up through Berea, Thessalonica, Philippi, Troas. And then in verse 4, and Sopater, okay, here we got a list of people who accompanied him. Sopater of Berea accompanied him to Asia. So he's coming around, up around the, through Philippi and then back down to Asia. Also, Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy and Tychicus, and Trophimus of Asia. So this is the group that is helping him, that's bringing the funds back to Judea. Remember, he told them, we're going to bring help out Judea. There's a famine going on. And each church would send somebody with them to bring these funds back. So here are seven who carried those funds. Aristarchus, of course, we just read about in chapter 19. He was the guy that was seized in Ephesus. So obviously he's back. And then in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2, it talks about the Macedonians. So Paul's talking in 2 Corinthians 8 about how kind and generous the Macedonians were in their giving. Which verse did I say that was? 8:2. That in great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. We want to be part of this, is what he's saying. And that's Macedonians' attitude towards it. And he's telling the Corinthians this, you know. So he's just telling. And then in Paul, when he wrote to the Romans, remember, from Corinth, he just wrote to Rome. And he tells them, we pray that Judea will accept this gift. So just that's a Jesus type of attitude, that not only are you giving something, but if you give something to somebody and say, we won't take anything from you, you pray that they will, that you don't get huffy and say, okay, never mind then. It's just that benevolence, that attitude of benevolence, that we want to do you good no matter what you feel about it. So they were praying for that. And of course, we find out that Judea accepted it and it was all a good thing. Verse 5, these men going ahead waited for us at Troas. So that group of seven men goes down to Troas. They waited for us, and that us pops up again. Who's us? Well, the writer of the book is Luke. And so he's back. So remember, we left him in Philippi. So he's coming back around through Philippi, and Paul and Luke, were together then, and were coming to Troas to meet these seven. But we sailed from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days joined them at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. So here they're coming down to Troas, Paul and Luke. It's days of unleavened bread are around April. It took them 5 days to get down. And remember, when they took the trip up a while back, chapter 16, they had great winds. It took them 2 days. On this trip, it takes them 5 days. So the winds are adverse in some way. And then they stayed 7 days in Troas, so they're going to be there on a Sunday. So here you have nine men to work 7 days at Troas. And remember, when he went up, a door was open there. And so now he's back. He's got nine men, and they're going to be teaching. Verse 7, now on the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul, ready to depart the next day, spoke to them and continued his message till midnight. So here is the verse that gives us some information about the Lord's Supper that we don't get anywhere else in the Bible. Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. And of course, Paul did too. He said, remember what Jesus said. He said, do this in remembrance of me. And then Paul tells us how we do it and why we do it. And Jesus says too, I'll take this new with you in my Father's kingdom. That was before the kingdom was there. Now the kingdom's here, and we take it with him. And then Paul also said, as often as you drink it or eat it, and then so it was to be done often, but we don't know how often until we get to this verse. So now on the first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread, so they were... That was the purpose of getting together, was to break bread. Paul, ready to depart the next day, spoke to them and continued his message until midnight. So that's where we find out it's on the first day of the week. It is also where we really see that it is the purpose for the church to gather, is to take the Lord's Supper. Now, Paul takes advantage of this and speaks too. It's when you think of... Well, I don't need to get into that. Let's go on to verse 8. There were many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered together. So now I'm going to try to light what these lamps were like. Uh-oh. Because what you've got is a situation here. Oh, I just blew it out. So there's a little first century lamp. And this is actually a one that we found when we were over there. And this was in the, when you, from the Pool of Siloam, there was a tunnel that we were digging in. And Jack went up into it to dig out some of the stuff. And I was a little too portly to get in there. But he would get bags of stuff and send it back down. And in some of those, we found that and a first century coin. And so these were the lamps that were used. When you hear many lights in an upper room, that's the type of thing it was. So you had many of these in a little room, in a room where they were gathered. And you can see there's some smoke coming off of it. You know, it's a little bit of heat. But you have a place that, let's see. Okay, let's describe this place. And in a window sat a certain young man named Eutychus, who was sinking into a deep sleep. He was overcome by sleep. And as Paul continued speaking, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. So here you're in this third floor, which the heat is coming up. You got these. It's probably a smoky room when you think of many lights like this and the smoke coming up. And it's crowded. The kid, the young man is sitting on the edge of the window. And it's about midnight. It's been a long sermon. And I think all of us, when we think of these two words, sinking into sleep and then overcome by sleep. You may have driven somewhere and you're sinking, you know, or you may have listened to a lesson and you're sinking, and then your Bible falls off your lap and you come back to whatever. We know that feeling, but that's what this kid, you know, this, I call him a kid, he's a young man, and he's in this window, and and he falls out, and he's on the third story. And but Paul went down, fell on him, and embracing him, said, "Do not trouble yourselves, for his life is in him." So, and that word for life is his breath. He's still breathing. He raised him from the dead. Eutychus means fortunate, which is a good name for him. Verse 11, now when he had come up, had broken bread and eaten, so this is another breaking of bread, but in this case, he says, we have eaten, this is a meal now. This is distinguished from that other breaking of bread that we just had in verse 7. And taken and talked a long while, even till daybreak, he departed. And they brought the young man in alive, and they were not a little comforted. So what is that like, you know, to have a guy in your town like Eutychus, and just that guy, Paul, raised from the dead, and he's there from now on, and any time, what does that mean to have somebody like that, it made me think of was Eve, little baby Eve, you know, that. And I realized little baby Eve was not, it wasn't a miracle with Eve, and it was with Eutychus. But when we look at little Eve, it's just like, you're alive, you're healthy. And we were all watching those months when she was born, and the doctors didn't even realize that it was even an earlier preemie than they thought. And it's only because of one nurse that said, we should do something. The rest were thinking, that's too early. Let her go. But somehow, and then all of us praying and thinking about it, and And then week by week, we're getting, she put on a couple ounces this week. And, oh, thank you. And then we see her now, and she just looks up at you with those big eyes. And it's just like, I think one day she's going to be told the story, and she'll go, that's why people look at me so funny. You know, because we do. I know I look at her and think, you're alive. You're healthy. And we have that among us. And what kind of effect is that on a congregation? It's just great. And here they had Eutychus, which it was a miracle. And, of course, it not only had that closeness of tying them together, but also of you know, there's a group meeting, a group of Christians. And why do you guys, what is this stuff you believe? Well, they talk about it, and here's a miracle in our town. And you can talk to a whole bunch of witnesses about what happened that day if you want to. And so so it just tremendous what the Lord left there in Troas. And I'm just to make a little aside, tonight I'm going to do a kind of two lessons, short lessons, on things that I didn't have time to cover as we went through Acts. And the two are, and one of them is, when did miracles cease and why? And we'll look at the miracles that Paul and the apostles left as they went through the cities. And when did that, why was that there, and when did it cease, and why did it cease? I've mentioned that they'll cease, but I've never in this class proven it. So we want to do that tonight. And then what is the church is responsible in helping the needy? And that's another thing that we're going through this time of Paul's life right now, when we're he's on these journeys and he's bringing help to different congregations. And we want to take a closer look at that and say, what is our responsibility as a church to helping the needy? So let's see, verse 13. Then we went ahead to the ship and sailed to Assos, there intending to take Paul on board, for so he had given orders, intending himself to go on foot. So when we look back at, wrong way. Going down from Troas down to Assos, they're intending to take Paul on board, for he had given orders, intending himself to go on foot. So he's going to walk across the land from Troas to Assos, about 20 miles. They're going to take the boat around, which is about 40 miles. And why? He had been up all night, and he goes, I'll walk the 20 miles. And so he had a lot of energy. He must have. And the only thing I can think of is that this has been just such a whirlwind of what's happening as he comes on this trip and the emotions he's gone through. I want to be alone. I just want to be alone for a while. And that's just a guess. But, you know, he's had this all-nighter and he wants to walk. Perhaps he wants to meditate, maybe give thanks for the way things turned out. And when he met us at Assos, we took him on board and came to Mytilene. And we'll pick it up there next week then at verse 15.